Great. Let me just share a few more bits, so then we can get back into to discussing some of the issues in detail a bit more. But just to give you a few things to chew on. I mean, I think, you know, I almost take for granted, but I don't want to take for granted. It's always good for us just to be soaked in the heart of God in the scriptures, and just how precious unity is and how dangerous disunity is. And we know that, and that is why it's so discouraging. But it's good just to hear these words again, just the danger of a church getting to the point of biting and devouring one another. That can happen. Paul warns the Galatians that they're going to end up like animals, just devouring one another. He says to the Ephesians, and you know the whole flow of Ephesians, how it's all building up that the work of Christ is to reconcile us with God, reconcile us with one another. It is the gospel that has brought us this unity. It's a huge cost of the death of the God-man. And, you know, make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. This is so precious. Make every effort. Philippians also has that that concern to stand firm in one spirit. And then later he says, make my joy complete. It's something that he really, really longs for. Make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. That is what he's driving for in that letter. And we've just been talking in Titus about the responsibility of the elders to silence the rebellious person, and at the end of Titus, warn a divisive person once, and then warn them again second time, and then have nothing to do with them. But it's a really, really serious thing, division, disunity, because unity is so precious, because it's brought by the death of Christ. At the same time as that, I think it is important to guard our heart in this. So the point of this diagram is that we start at the center of that, okay, with discouragement, and that could well be a very godly and right affection, emotion, because, you know, you love the people, you're concerned about the church, you know you're deeply grieved when there is division, and it's grieving against, you know, what Christ has done through the gospel. Is you're grieved for the people personally. You love them, and there's a deep discouragement when you see that disagreements and divisions in the church, and that's, you know, very often good and right. I mean, it could be just that you're discouraged that this is going to put a brake on church growth, and this is, you know, not going to look so good in the prayer letter and stuff like that. But you know, let's take it. It's a good godly discouragement. The thing is, it can go either way. A bit like anger can morph into different sort of go in different directions. Discouragement can easily go off in different directions. It can quite quickly lead to bitterness. So it starts with kind of a godly discouragement, but it can slip into an annoyance with people, a harshness, a bitterness, a sourness. And I think that comes because I'm viewing church as a project, and people are just not getting with the program, and this is annoying. You know, when you've set up a kind of a good system and people are just not going with it, and it's like, can you just all line up with this? Why do we have, you know, this disagreement, this division is just annoying. And I've forgotten the people really, and I've just started to view the church as a project. I've also forgotten how much I'm in need of the gospel myself. So I kind of forget that I'm a fellow sinner, and how patient God has been with me. That comes into it, and I'm forgetting the presence of God with me. I just go into kind of sort it out mode. I go into kind of strategize, plan mode. I need to fix this. It's just me and this project, the church, and the Lord is out of the picture. The opposite to that is where I'm remembering it's about the people. So it's not the project, I've got to love and respect for people. I love these people, And I'm respecting them. And I was talking to Duncan Forbes about this the other day. I think he's done a lot of work on the image of God. And he just keeps reminding me, God has given people brains. And he's given them, because they're in the image of God, they have the ability to make judgments and decisions and to decide things. And so they're not for me to sort of to make up all their decisions for them and to lord over their conscience. I need to love people and respect them, that actually they will have different opinions on things, and that they have a God-given ability to assess things. Also, I'm on this side, I'm aware of my own need for grace. I'm very aware that God has been extremely patient with me, that I'm naturally going off in my own direction. I'm not naturally submissive. I'm not naturally rational. That God has been very, very kind to me. I'm a sinner saved by grace. And that softens me towards people. And I'm remembering that the Lord is near, that he is with me. He hasn't abandoned me. He's sovereign over this situation. Jesus is coming back soon. This is only for a time. But he's in this with me by his Spirit. And I think all those things lead to a sort of a hopefulness. So yes, it's discouraging, but going that side of the diagram is tending off towards thinking that there is hope there. There is opportunity. And this is something that the Santosh was helping me with the other day, Santosh Thomas, that, you know, try and see the silver lining, the opportunities in when there is division and conflict. There are loads of them. Here's just a few of the things that God could be doing through a division and disagreement, the opportunities, the not that it's good in itself necessarily, it might be actually quite a destructive thing in and of itself, but it can be something that's redeemed, that's used, that God is using, and it's an opportunity. And as we go on that sort of hope side of the diagram, we start to see the opportunities more. So, I mean, the first one is it's an opportunity to be humbled, for me to be humbled, maybe for us as a church to be humbled. There's when we're united and everything's going all swimmingly, it is easy to be proud and think like, yeah, this is we're like a powerful ship here plowing on in the same direction. But when we start to kind of fall apart a bit, we realize that we are very broken, and that there's a humbling in that. Judges 20 is that bit when there's basically civil war within God's inheritance. You know, God's inheritance in the New Testament is his church. My understanding is God's inheritance in the Old Testament is his people. And so there are lessons we can learn from this. You can't transfer it exactly, but it is a shocking thing at the end of Judges where you get the tribes of Israel fighting each other. Now, they're not fighting other people now. They're not fighting the Amalekites or something. They're fighting each other. And the tribes are basically having a go at Benjamin. They're kind of exercising a kind of church discipline, you could say. But at first, they run into it in quite a kind of a hot kind of way. They're like, we're right. These guys are absolutely horrendous. I can't believe they did what they did in Gibeah. And we're going to totally bosh them. And so they run in there, and God actually gives them a defeat, and they go back, and then they have another go, and they have another kind of defeat, and then they have another one. And you see through that chapter, God is humbling them and bringing them down to that point that they're sort of weeping and on the floor, and they're like, God, they're in a different place, if that makes sense. It's a little bit like the end of Genesis where Joseph's brothers have to go backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards from Israel to Egypt. And God is through that, he's bringing them down, he's humbling them. There's a similar kind of thing in Judges 20. And I think these sort of disagreements and divisions, and they're painful, but they are one of the ways that God humbles us and brings us down as a church. Another thing that division and disagreement does is it kind of brings to the surface stuff that you wouldn't otherwise see. So quite often our values and our agendas, our fears, our desires, they're hidden. And yet when you have these kind of things, and I've seen this recently, with just in a small group, that you suddenly, these sort of kind of conflicts and divisions bring to the surface what people's agenda is and what they value most. And sometimes that's good and sometimes it's bad, but it gives you the opportunity to talk about those things, to talk about what might be idols, to talk about whether it's someone's fear of death, or their massive, you know, disproportionate fear of losing their job or being demoted, you know, which is an understandable fear, but it might be this is a really big thing for this person that wasn't shown up before, and how they feel about the church. You know, how do you really look at the church? Oh, this is actually bringing this to light in a new way. Also, similarly but slightly different, I think it was a church planter who was pointing out that he thought everybody was with his vision and he thought everyone was kind of aligned, and then there were these kind of disagreements and he realized, oh, hang on a minute, you know, some of the guys I thought were really key and core, they're actually on a really quite a different vision here, and it could be a misunderstanding or it could be a misalignment that is not going to be able to be bridged, but it gives at least an opportunity to clarify what the vision is and see where people stand, which can be helpful. Also, I think it depends. I mean, sometimes with a disagreement or a division, it's very clear this side is right and this side is wrong. But sometimes it can be a helpful thing in terms of bringing to the surface different solutions, different ideas. You know, if we do believe that everybody is created in the image of God and given the ability to assess and judge that all those that God's children are filled with the Spirit and have that ability to come to good insights, then maybe it's a good thing that people don't always agree with me, because they might have like actually better ideas, and there might be things I haven't thought through very well. And through this disagreement and hearing different voices, we actually come up with some better ways forward. I mean, it's different when you've had the whole discussion and you've agreed on something, and then people are still disagreeing. That's a bit different. But some kind of if there's never any disagreements in a church, that's a bit worrying. It's a creative thing actually to have disagreement. It also gives us an opportunity to love one another. It's difficult to love one another in some ways when we're all totally on the same page. When people start going off in different directions, and we need to kind of bridge conflicts, we need to flex to one another, we need to kind of have those difficult conversations, it's a laboratory of learning to love one another. And it also, on an outward facing kind of level, it does demonstrate the power of the gospel. If we can work through these disagreements and divisions, not kind of paper them over and sort of like, oh, we're not going to talk about that in here, but to actually talk about things and get through them in a way that the world cannot even talk about, you know, that they actually, you just get shot down on a WhatsApp group or you know, just closed down. To be able to do that in the church does demonstrate the power of the gospel. And another possible opportunity, which again Santosh was helping me see, was that these things do sometimes create more opportunities for gospel ministry than they would have otherwise. So you might find that there's somebody who is just or a group of people who are disagreeing, not willing to be part of a particular thing, that kind of maybe pushes you towards them to have the kind of the one-to-ones that you wouldn't have got around to otherwise, or to form people into prayer triplets, or to go to a different level. Also, I mean, just on the Paul and Barnabas, when they divided, they both probably, you know, did more than they would have done if they'd stayed together in Acts 15. Sometimes a division and a parting of the ways can actually end up with two churches where there would have been one, and sometimes two good churches. It's not always a negative thing. It can actually be good for gospel ministry and mission. So seeing those opportunities, reframing it, I guess, is what we're saying. Worth saying that there's different sorts of divisions. They're not all the same. So there's probably different ways to chop this up, but Acts 6 with the Hellenic widows and the Hebrew widows, that's a systemic problem. So the way that they deal with it is not by preaching sermons or kind of doing biblical counseling or whatever it is. They change the system. And sometimes there is some injustice, there's some kind of, it's a right disagreement about something that does actually lead to a change in the system. Acts 15 is a different issue. It's a theological issue. You know, that's a division over how should we relate to the Gentiles? How do the Gentiles come into the church? And they have to do some biblical theology, and they have to look at Amos, and they have to kind of think these things through theologically with the Spirit together, and they come out with basically a theological conclusion that they communicate in a wise way. Later on in Acts 15, you've got that's a division of Paul and Barnabas. And it's difficult to know exactly what it's over. I mean, we could just turn to it quickly, because I think it is an interesting one. And you might have some other ideas in terms of what exactly is going on here, but let me just read those verses. So Paul and Barnabas, verse 36, say, "Let us go back and visit the believers in all the towns where we preach the word of God and see how they're doing." Barnabas wanted to take John, also called Mark, his cousin, with them, but Paul didn't think it wise to take him, because he had deserted them in Pamphylia and had not continued with them in the work. They had such a sharp disagreement, sharp, you know, sort of goad type word. They had a sharp disagreement that they parted company. Barnabas took Mark and Paul chose Silas. And they go off and they both do ministry together, but separately with those two different teams. And there's mention of wisdom. There's mention of thinking. There's Barnabas wanted to take John, or I think the word is planned. So there's planning, there's wisdom. It seems to me there's some kind of difference in strategy, difference in wisdom, perhaps a difference in priorities. So it could be that Barnabas is putting a priority on mentoring. Mark, he's putting a priority on second chances. He's putting a priority on trusting that the Spirit can still use this guy and he can be helpful. Paul is perhaps putting a particular emphasis and priority on the good of the church, the good of the reputation of the gospel, the good of the dynamics of the team, and he doesn't want to take that risk at this point. Take Mark with him, even though later he does. So it's not like it would never happen. He does use Mark in the future, but at this point he doesn't think that's the right thing to do. I don't know if anyone's got any ideas further than that on exactly what's going on there.
I wonder whether, just in terms of their different personalities and their different experiences, there might be different things that kind of put the red flag up for different people. So so Paul, you know, with his, you know, very, if it was a problem with the whole Jewish, for wanting to go back to that kind of thing, then he would be very hot on kind of picking up on that. Whereas if there was other people who perhaps hadn't been steeped in it quite as much, they might not. I'm not certain that that's the particular situation here, but I'm just saying that there might have been other apostles who weren't quite, hadn't had experience of the depths of the kind of Judaism that Paul had, and therefore he might have been slightly quicker to say, no, this is a really important issue, it's really difficult. We can't compromise on this. Whereas others might not see that.
Are you thinking of the earlier in Acts 15, the kind of the Jerusalem council?
Yeah, I guess so.
I think there's certainly It's a very, the issue they deal with at the top of chapter 15 is like a serious theological issue they have to get sorted out. It's interesting that at the end of chapter 15, these two guys are totally on the same page theologically, because they've just, you know, they've just signed off on this thing together and they're going to communicate it.
Yeah.
But they have a sharp disagreement about who to take with them. And perhaps there's things going on there about loyalty, in that, you know, Paul values loyalty very, very highly, and the fact that this guy's let him down is a really serious thing for him. Although maybe Barnabas takes loyalty in a different direction and says, well, you know, we're going to be loyal to this guy because and give him a second chance. But I think it's an interesting one, that it's it doesn't seem to be particularly theological. But there's a division. They decide to, quite a kind of a parting, which does actually end up with more gospel ministry happening. Mm. And it could be that sometimes we're not going to get on the same page with people. We are going to have different strategies, and it's like, fine, if you don't, you do that with people. Sorry, go on, John.
So I'm just going to say, I'm not sure we can learn too much on this from it. I think it's a real honest passage, isn't it? Which I think is really helpful. And then we do see the reconciliation later when they are reunited. So I'm not sure I would draw too much from it in terms of what we're trying to think about here, other than there's honesty that we will struggle with divisions. But beautifully, we do see there is reconciliation between these brothers later on in the book. And I guess that's the big thing, isn't it? That's always our aim, is that reconciliation.
Thank you, John. That's very wise. That's very wise. We don't want to take too much of the narrative. And I was tempted to put a question mark after the divide thing, because I think you're right. We don't want to kind of principalize everything and turn it into a sort of a law. I think you're right. There's an honesty there. But there, I guess the key thing here is just that there are different sorts of divisions, and they probably do need handling in slightly different ways. Titus, I guess, not a narrative passage, prescriptive, and there is a certain sort of rebelliousness, division, divisiveness, which is a high-handed. It's not just someone's badly taught; they're actually causing division, and that needs squashing or just separation. And then Philippians has got this interesting passage at the end with Euodia and Syntyche, which again, it's not exactly clear what's going on here, but it is clear what Paul's heart is towards them, and he's been building up to it in some ways throughout the letter. And he says, my brothers and sisters, you whom I love and long for, my joy and crown. Very, very warm language, isn't it? Stand firm in the Lord in this way, dear friends. I plead, I beg, exhort, beseech Euodia, and I plead with Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, my true companion, help these women, since they've contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my co-workers whose names are in the book of life. And again, commentators differ on exactly what the issue is here. But I take it that because he's referring very clearly that one mind, the same mind, that's very clearly linking back to chapter 2, which was kind of at the heart of the letter, having that mind of Christ, that mind that is not concerned just for my own interests, but for the interests of others and the interests of Christ. So I take it that there's some kind of tension between these two here, probably in ministry. They're co-workers, they're gospel workers. It's not some trivial thing. They perhaps have different ideas about how to go forward with some particular ministry, but that's leading to some kind of tension between them. And he seems to be anti-individualistic in this passage. So it's very plural, brothers and sisters, my friends. He's talking about them as talks about yoke fellow. He talks about co-workers, that they're together, they're in the book of life. So he seems to be kind of trying to go against that sort of idea of it's just me and I've got my idea and I'm going this way and this person's got their idea and they're going that way. He's bringing them together in the Lord. In the Lord, there's union with Christ there. There's a destination. There's the book of life. There's assurance. So the gospel themes that have been running through his letter kind of come together here. And I wonder what, I think there's different sorts of tensions in our churches, but I wonder whether this is not an uncommon one, that there are tensions between good people who have just different ideas, different ways of doing things, and Paul is applying the gospel here. So that's not always what happens in the New Testament. It's not always just we apply the gospel because there's different things that need to happen in different cases, but that's a lovely example of that. Just something on, this slightly fits with the stuff that Perks was talking about, knowing yourself. This is not authoritative, but I think it's helpful. It's kind of from the biblical counselling type world. I don't know if you've read Winston Smith's Marriage Matters book. This is kind of I've slightly adapted a diagram that he's done there. And basically, this is not to kind of categorise people. I think we all kind of drift between different ones, but we might have one that we gravitate towards. There's the, in terms of conflict, our tendency might be to move away from it, to withdraw, to move against it in an aggressive way, or to move towards it in an appeasing way. And that was the one that was a bit new to me. So I think when we had our sort of pre-marriage counselling stuff, and they talked about the hedgehog and the rhino. I don't know if anyone's come across that idea. You know, the hedgehog and the rhino. But the hedgehog, when there's conflict, goes away, rolls into a ball, and puts out its spines. And it's this sort of retreat, trying to ignore the problem and sort of defensive posture. The rhino, when there's conflict, goes towards it and is like, I'm going to sort this out and I'm going to win. The one that I wasn't familiar with was the sort of more teddy bear one, which is to move towards with a desire to appease, which actually kind of, I think, like, well, surely that's right. We shouldn't we be moving towards people in love? But I think what Winston Smith points out is that there can be some sort of idols beneath each of these things. So with the hedgehog, there's the idol could be security, safety. With the rhino, there could be an idol of wanting to be admired and to win, to be successful. With the kind of teddy bear, there can be an idol of wanting to be accepted. So actually, it might be that I'm running in to sort things out, not in it, partly fueled by a desire for everyone to like me, basically. And the fears are just the flip sides of that. So the hedgehog is fearing pain, basically. The rhino is fearing failure or weakness. And the teddy bear is fearing shame and rejection. So I guess the thing to say is that in different sorts of divisions and disagreements, conflicts, we just got to check ourselves a little bit. And it could be that we're going into this from godly desires. We have the Spirit of God. I'm not saying we're totally driven by these things, but we just need to be aware, am I retreating from this or going towards this because I'm driven by one of these things? And it could be that, I'm wanting to be the teddy bear, but actually this is the time when it's a Titus 3 type thing and it actually needs some distance and to be silenced. Or it could be that I'm going towards this in a rhino type way, but actually this is a time for people to be loved and heard. And does that make sense? So it's just a know yourself, just be aware of what your tendency will be, and sometimes you'll have to go against that, and depending on what sort of division it is. This is just getting towards the end here. This is something that again, talking with Santosh about these things the other day, particularly in terms of the whole coronavirus thing, which I know is kind of an issue for a number of us at the moment. And these are some things that he helped me with, and some other people have as well. And one of them was to love people with time. So people, if they know you love them and you've spent time with them and you've actually taken the time to pick up the phone or gone to see them, that love does really do a lot to break down barriers. And so it's to love people just with the time that you give them, and people appreciate that more than you expect. Also, that it's not wrong to educate the conscience. So you do need to be careful of people's consciences. And I think particularly in this issue and a number of other issues, people will say, well, I've got a conscience about this. I really don't feel that X, Y, and Z, and it would be against my conscience to do X, Y, and Z. And that's fine. We do need to be really careful with people's consciences, but it's not wrong to educate people's consciences. So it could be that their conscience is informed by completely wrong information. And they've just got a completely, either it's just a completely irrational fear, or it's something that's just not true. You know, it's either some kind of strange kind of conspiracy theory they've got off the internet, or it's, you know, it's an irrational fear that the police are going to be battering down my door, or, you know, whatever it is, that there might be a place for educating, just, you know, not in a heavy-handed way, but just kind of giving people the information that they need. And another thing was this thing about fear, that you may have heard this argument before, that when you're in a period of sort of crisis, fear, people can start to flick from I will do something unless I'm told not to, into a disposition of I will only do something if I'm permitted to. I don't know if that makes sense. So basically what can happen is you can get a state in a family, community, country, where we get to a point where actually, unless someone gives me explicit permission to do something, I'm worried that I'm not allowed to do it. Rather than the sort of peacetime scenario of, well, obviously I do everything that I'm allowed to do, you know, I'll do everything naturally unless I'm explicitly told not to do it. So, and I think that can be the case at the moment, that, you know, unless someone tells me I'm allowed to go out the door, I'm not going to go out the door. Or unless there's a sign on this bench saying this is a COVID secure bench, then I won't be able to sit on this bench, because I'm not sure. Is there some kind of guidance on benches and park benches in the government guidance? And it's a sort of, I'm not trying to make a political point, but I think it's a sort of a psychological thing that can happen, where people start to give over all their decision making to someone else. And so it's quite important to kind of empower people back with a bit of decision making, and actually, you know, you can make your own decisions on things. We want to submit to the authorities, but we don't give in to fear. And also a general disposition that we need to fight for, that we want to meet together. So you might have valid fears, you might have invalid fears, or you might decide you can or you can't do something, but our general disposition surely should be we want to meet together. There's kind of fighting against that individualism, which just says it's just me or it's just my family and we're going to do what's best for us. Well, let's think about what the church is, and let's think about what is best for us as a church, while being respectful of people's different situations, obviously, and health needs and stuff. But is there a basic disposition that we want to meet together or not? And then the final thing, that again, this is Santosh helped me with, this was just, let's just have a disposition of cheerfulness, because there's so little cheerfulness in the world. There's so much kind of glumness, there's so much negativity. You know, not that we kind of go around with silly smiles on our faces, but surely the gospel should give us a kind of I guess it's another way of saying joy, isn't it? But a cheerfulness, but actually let's communicate people with people in a way that is loving, but is positive, that is hopeful, because we do have a Father, and there is the Good Shepherd, and there is an end in sight.